and welcome to the show. We're both a little tired from the weekend that we just had, where we got to talk with Tony.
Take two.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about a boogie woogie, and I'm going to play one.
I'm Steve Vinson.
I'm Paul Schultz.
And this is the Don't Panic Radio Show. Sit back, relax, and ignore the news. Nothing you're about to hear is true.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
Welcome to the show. We are both very excited and both very exhausted. I would imagine you're a little more exhausted than me.
I sleep with these headphones on.
Yeah, what you do in your personal life is your own personal business.
That's right.
It was fun talking with Tony, and then it was fun doing the recap afterwards. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness my wife was there, or we could have kept talking all night long.
Yeah. We keep her around for a reason.
I'll have to remember to bring microphones next time, though, because while I thought you sounded good on our live spot, I sounded like I was in a giant tin can.
I just leaned into the microphone like I took a cue from Larry King and I just leaned in, and it seemed to help.
Smart. You can do worse than taking a cue from Larry King. Regardless, we did have a big announcement in our live show. And that is that we were going to do segments in more digestible length for you guys. Still the same amount of content, just breaking it up into shorter episodes to make it a little more focused and succinct. Right. Today is the first one of those. And we're going to do a little something I like to call soft core history.
Oh, yeah.
This is the next installment in my series on the Civil War. If you missed the previous ones, I'll get you caught up here real quick. The last one was after the election of Abraham Lincoln as president of the United States. Several southern states seceded from the Union, including South Carolina. Their contention was that the United States federal government didn't have the right to tell them what they could do with the Africans that they had imported from the continent of Africa.
Imported.
And that they had bred. Yeah, imported. And that they had bred in captivity and treated them no better than cattle. They didn't feel like the federal government had the right to tell them they couldn't do that. So they seceded from the Union. And Lincoln did everything he could to... Depending on who you believe, based on the research I read, Lincoln did everything he could to try to prevent hostilities from breaking out, to try to bring the rebel states back into the fold peacefully. But he did put his foot down and said, we're not going to surrender any of our properties in the South unless they're taken by force. And in the last episode, we heard Fort Sumter was taken by force by the rebel army commanded by General Beauregard at the time. So the North, now you're all caught up. Well, actually, you're not caught up. There was another episode. It was asynchronous. This episode happened prior, and it was actually the thing that kind of gave me the idea to do a series where I talked about sometime after Fort Sumter, when it was clear there was going to be a war, the Union, President Lincoln specifically, asked General Robert Lee to be, or Colonel Robert Lee of the United States Army, to take command of a northern of a Union army. He refused and resigned and left his Arlington, Virginia home. At the time, it wasn't called Arlington, but it was in Virginia, right across the, it was Arlington House at the time, near Alexandria, Virginia. But if you go to Washington, D.C. today, I mean, you can see it from, you can stand on one side of the Potomac in Washington, D.C., and you can see the Arlington Cemetery and Arlington House on the other side. So that's where Lee was living. That's Virginia. He left, took command of an army, a Virginian army. But he wasn't yet the commander in chief of, he wasn't the commander of the army, of all of the armed forces. That was General Beauregard. Okay, so now you're caught up. General Lee has resigned his commission. Lincoln had tried to keep Virginia from joining the rebellion, but as you found out, Virginia joined the rebellion as well. After Lincoln had called up 75,000 Union troops for a 90-day tour of duty. The reason it was 90 days is everybody figured that's about how long it would take to run down there, give the rebels what's for, you know, crush the rebellion, get all the federal properties back, and just help the traitors realize they'd made the wrong choice. Well, the benefit of hindsight, right? Well, not much had happened between the April of 1861, when Fort Sumter fell, in July of 1861. Not a lot had happened other than just calling up a bunch of troops in the North. Meanwhile, the South was busy raising their own armies and training and getting ready. One famous drill, he wasn't a sergeant, but one drill instructor was a guy by the name of Thomas Jackson. And we'll hear more about Thomas in a future episode, but keep that in mind. One of the things he was good at was training soldiers. He was a Confederate officer at the time. Thomas Jackson. So by the time July 21st rolled around, everybody was getting pretty impatient, and the Army of the North of the Union was finally pressed to do something. Well, it turns out that about 35-ish miles south of Washington, D.C., remember, Washington, D.C. is our capital, and it was back then as well. So it was the seat of government of the federal United States of the Union. Just across the Potomac River was Virginia, which is the South. Yeah. About 30, 35 miles south of that was this place called Manassas Junction. And the Confederate Army had a large presence there. 30 miles. Imagine 30 miles for a second. I think LaPorte's about 30 miles from Michigan City, give or take.
Give or take, yeah.
That's nothing. You can drive that in about 20 minutes. I've done it many times. Wow, you can drive 30 miles in 20 minutes? Yeah, I go pretty fast. But try walking it. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in a second. But in the meantime, everybody's screaming. You have this large Confederate army 30 miles south of here. What are you going to do about it? So Lincoln sent, estimates vary, but somewhere around 15,000 Union troops. And to just basically go take care of this. This is an important, Manassas Junction is an important rail junction. They'll take care of that. And then Richmond's not too much farther away. Richmond, Virginia, being at that time the seat of government for the Confederates, or at least for Virginia. And, you know, they could take care of that. This thing will be over, you know, in no time. That's kind of the narrative of what gets us to where we are. I like reading first person accounts of what goes on. I couldn't find one that I really liked, but I found a description of a person's firsthand account of this period. Her name is Mary Henry, and she was the daughter of the first director of the Smithsonian Institution, whose name was Joseph Henry. And there's a summary of her diary entries around this time, written by somebody by the name of Allie Desrochers. I don't know how to pronounce that. Who was an intern in 2011 at the Institutional History Division of the Smithsonian Institution. We'll put the link in the show notes because that will constitute fair use, because I'm going to read several passages out of this. So we got our copyrights handled.
Got our copyright ducks in a row.
That's right. So I mentioned Manassas Junction. The Confederates called this battle that's about to take place the First Battle of Manassas. I'm always wondering about that. How did they know there was going to be another one? The North calls it the Battle of Bull Run. Mm-hmm. So that's what we heard in our history books, was the Battle of Bull Run near Manassas Junction. So from the summary from the Smithsonian website, on July 21st, 1861, the First Battle of Manassas raged just 30 miles south of Washington, D.C., and the Smithsonian Institution building that housed Secretary Joseph Henry and his family. His eldest daughter, Mary, kept a detailed account of events in the Capitol during this battle and throughout the Civil War. As the seat of the Union government and on the boundary of the warring Confederacy, D.C. stood precariously in the center of the conflict. Mary Henry, therefore, had a prominent vantage point from which to view the battle's developments and encounter its participants. Now, the thing that struck me was when I think about the Civil War, I think, well, the South, they seceded. The North, you know, the Union took some troops down there. They had a few battles. The South won some. The North won some. We had Gettysburg, and it was all downhill from there. But when you read something like, this is 30 miles away. Now, I try to put myself in, like, Mary's mindset, okay? First of all, I'm a man, and maybe at that time being a man would mean warrior-like. So I might have been thinking of glory and how this is going to be easy, and how it'll be over in no time, right? Uh-huh. Mary had a little bit of a different take. She watched the procession sort of like it was a parade almost, uh-huh, advancing into Virginia, and she watched it from the tower. If you see pictures of the First Smithsonian Institution building, there's like this tower that she called the castle, okay? But from this summary, she knew many men among those soldiers heading to war, and so remarked that she could not feel patriotic. Instead, she felt sadness and concern, dreading the bloodshed to come. So she knew this wasn't going to be a walk in the park, right? But somehow all the generals and all the newspaper men and, in fact, Congress and the Senate thought we were going to, you know, we're going to go down there, we're going to whip these good old boys, and we'll be done. To the point that a lot of senators and some congressmen actually went down there to watch. So it's maybe like an 8 or 12 hour ride in a carriage, you know, to go that 20, 30 miles. So these guys were sitting there like cheering the troops on, right? Go on, guys, this will be great. On the Sunday that the battle happened, they could hear it from Washington. So like Mary was still back in Washington and she could hear it going. And like members of her church had friends, and one of her friends, Fanny was her name, was really upset because there was no news, really. I mean, they just kind of heard that maybe there were some battles going on. And they could hear, like, there were ambulances coming back from the battle and some wounded soldiers coming back. But they still really didn't know what was going on down there. The senators found out fairly quickly what was going on down there. Because what happened is so the Union troops go down. He's got about 15,000 men. Well, the South had something on the order of 35,000 men. But still, these green troops who had barely been trained, remember, they were only called up for 90 days and they had already been in for 60 days or so, but they hadn't gotten a ton of training in that time. But still, they were pushing the Southerners back. And so the senators, everybody thought, oh, this is going exactly how we thought it would. We'll be in Richmond in a couple of days. This thing will be over. We can all write our memoirs and, you know, get rich and famous. for crushing this rebellion, right? Sometime in the middle of the day, after all this, what felt like a lot of success, they encountered the brilliant tactician, Thomas Jackson. And what had happened is, and I mean, this happens throughout history. Anybody who studies military history like Jackson did when he was a teacher at the Virginia Military Institute would know that this is a tactic used over and over again in history. The most famous one was probably Genghis Khan, who's really good about making you think you were winning, stretching your lines out, but then retreating to a defensive position and then outflanking you. And that's exactly what happened.
Yep.
Next thing you know, the North thinks they're winning and they get into a position. They look around and there's cavalry capturing their artillery because their artillery was strung out, not protected. Uh-huh. And then the whole rebel army, you know, with that rebel yell, just starts rushing at them and they just broke. They just broke like, you know, waves against the rock wall. So these senators are like trying to go forward. And I was reading some reporters articles where they're talking about, yeah, I'm trying to get to the front to see what's going on. I can't really see. I want to get to the top of this hill, see if I can see what's going on. I know we're winning and I want to be there, watch them win. And suddenly he can't really get forward because of everybody that's going the other direction. And these senators, one of them is just like, what are these guys doing? And they're like, you're going the wrong way. Turn around, go back the other way. And they're like, they're whipping us up there. And one of the senators grabs a rifle and starts threatening to shoot soldiers who are trying to retreat. He's like, you turn around and go back. As far as I know, he didn't actually shoot anybody. One congressman was captured and held prisoner in Richmond, Virginia for 6 months as a prisoner of war.
Huh.
So, I've said this similar things before. Imagine doing that today. Imagine Senator, what's his name, going over to Afghanistan, uh-huh. like picking up a rifle and going, hey, you guys, get back after ISIS. Come on. So, they were in church on the 21st. And after church, they went to stay with a friend. And so the next morning, they're having breakfast. And now back to the summary. And I'm talking about Mary and her friends. The door was open to two soldiers, bloodstained and dusty. They brought both the good news that Fanny's man was well and the terrible story of the battle. One of the soldiers burst into tears three times during the telling of his tale. So horrible was the battle. Later that morning, Mary watched as the remains of the Rhode Island Regiment filed back into Washington, describing them as looking weary and exhausted. On July 23rd, a soldier visited the Smithsonian Building to describe the battle to Joseph Henry and spoke of both the disorganization and inability of the Union Army, which had caused such devastating losses. For days after confusion ruled, soldiers crowded the streets of D.C., tending their wounds and telling their stories. The Union Army was so devastated that its men were dispersed and left on their own without instruction from the commanding officers. On July 29th, a grieving man sought Joseph Henry's advice on how to go about visiting the battlefield to search for the body of his fallen son. Mary learned details of the battle, but an exact total of casualties later estimated to be 4,700 killed and wounded was not available due to the disordered retreat. This is interesting to me. And I could probably do a whole series just on this moment in history. Because had the Confederates known, and maybe they did know, but they just couldn't really do anything about it. But had they known and had they had the wherewithal to capitalize on this, think about it. 30 miles south. Now, they just pushed back the Union advance. So now they're probably 20 miles away from the capital. If they had kept going from that point, it's undefended, basically.
Yeah.
Because, as they say, they're just kind of hanging out in the streets, you know? She's just watching them. I imagine that, you know, that scene from Wonder Woman where they're marching across the bridge during World War I, where she's marching you know, going toward the battle, and they're coming back, and these guys have that 1,000-yard stare.
Yeah.
Except it's, you know, dudes without arms and legs, yes, but they're wearing the, you know, they're wearing the Union Army uniforms instead of the World War One uniforms. That, I mean, basically Washington's undefended at this point. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of when, okay, this is a callback of mighty proportions, but it reminded me also of when Hannibal invaded Italy during the war with Carthage, between Rome and Carthage. Hannibal defeated 80,000, an army of 80,000 with his army of 50,000. And that was pretty much all they had, all the Romans had. They're like, oh, crap, right? So then he did it again. So then they like raise another like fresh army, right? New recruits. We put another army in the field. And he did it again. And so at this point, he just destroyed two huge armies. And Rome is just freaking out because they're like, there is nothing between Hannibal and Rome except a few walls, which, you know, they could defend Rome pretty well from those walls, but they were just a, you know, 60-day siege away from just... And back in those days, when they took over a city, they took over a city.
Yeah.
There was, I mean, they just, when Rome eventually, for a view as to what the Carthaginian army might have done to Rome, had they taken it, all you got to do is look at what Rome did to Carthage when they took Carthage. Hey, have you ever heard of Carthage other than in the history books? No, you can't. If you tried to get a flight to Carthage today, that you can't, because there is no Carthage. There hasn't been a Carthage for 2,000 years because of what the Romans did when they took over Carthage. That would have happened to Rome, and yeah, we'd all be speaking African now, or at least Carthaginian.
Carthaginian. That's how Mike Tyson says Carthaginian. Carthaginian.
That's true.
Figureth got Carthaginian.
So you try to imagine being in Washington at this time when there's nothing between this huge, well, huge... by the standards of the early part of the war, mm-hmm. you know, 30,000 person army. Mm-hmm. They got much bigger as time went on, but this army of rebels, there's nothing. I mean, your army just got its ass kicked, and now they're laying around in the streets with the 1,000-yard stare. Mm-hmm. And what would the rebels have done if they had gotten to Washington, D.C.? You got to be thinking about that if you're back in that day. Mm-hmm. But eventually... Mary became sort of accustomed to war and its consequences. This wasn't the last time the Confederate Army would approach D.C. And, you know, eventually I'll get to that one. I think that's when they attacked across the Antietam Creek in Maryland. But we'll get to that at a future time. I think that's enough for this one right now. I want to include, I'll cover Antietam, of course. I'll cover Gettysburg. I'll cover a few more pivotal battles. But I think the key takeaway for me in this one, this was not a war that we knew we were going to win from the beginning.
No, I think, yeah. Well, Lincoln tried to avoid it as much as possible. So that's your first clue.
Yeah, I mean, he knew. Well, I think he had two things in mind, I think. One was, we don't want war because war equals bad, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But also, if we have war, then the chances of keeping the Union together as a, you know, united country of people that share an ideal mm-hmm. become very slim, because now you just had a war, right? Yeah. And I think we're still seeing the consequences of that war
yeah.
today, 156 years later, you know, or so, however many.
So you're saying they were 30 miles away, probably 20 by the time the battle was over.
Yeah.
So if they would have kept going and the tides would have changed, we all would have been speaking Southern.
That's right, y'all. And the South will rise again.
So, you know, I was thinking about a couple shows ago, we were talking about, I was talking about how I have friends who, like, identify with, you know, the Confederate, you know, side of the war. And I think what I think they've romanticized it a little bit. They don't really realize what that means to them. I think what they latch onto is the fact that, you know, they thought this was going to be a 90-day war, and the Confederates lasted how long?
From 1861 to 1865, so
yeah.
4 years.
So for a 90-day war turned into 4 years, and I think that's what these people hold on to in their heads is the whole resistance idea, but they don't really realize what that resistance meant.
Yeah, the broader philosophical issues are interesting as well. I grew up with a family that romanticized the resistance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of my take on it for decades of my life.
Yeah.
And I think there's reason to be proud. I mean, I don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, you can't be proud of your heritage or of how hard your ancestors fought. Where I draw the line is the cause that the leaders had, you know?
Yeah.
Our ancestors, my ancestors were not generals and statesmen. They were cotton farmers and the soldiers on the front line. And the cause they were fighting for is the cause every soldier in the history of soldiery, in the history of war, has ever fought for. And that is the guy next to you in the ranks, right?
Yeah.
And home. You know, the thought that the federal government was sending in troops to your homeland. And at that time, remember, the United States wasn't even 100 years old yet.
No.
So at that time, there was much more infinity, much. It's only so much infinity. Can't have more infinity. There was more affinity for your home state than necessarily for the federal government. Uh-huh. You know, people didn't necessarily go, hey, I'm so proud to be a United States of American. No, I'm proud to be a Virginian. I'm proud to be from Indiana. I'm proud to, you know, that's what. So to imagine that a federal government, you know, raised an army and now they're invading my homeland. Yeah, I'll get a group together with my buddies, you know, unless you read the newspapers and knew all the details of the issues of the day, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I think it's okay to be proud of their courage and their valor and their sacrifice. But again, as I said, I draw the line when it comes to the cause they were fighting for.
Right.
The overall cause.
Right.
So. But, yeah, the considering that the North successfully blockaded the South, which meant they couldn't get supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Considering they were an agricultural economy and not an industrial economy like the North.
Right.
The North had all the cards. It should not have lasted 4 years. If Lincoln had been able to find a decent general to command the army, it would not have been 4 years.
Right. You know,
but it basically became a war of attrition that the North was able to outlast. But this was not a segment about the entire war. This is how it all starts off.
Yeah.
You know, we thought it'd be over in 90 days and it is a bloody battle, but there's more to come and it gets even worse.
Yeah. This isn't American history in high school, kids.
That having been said, now you have softcore history you can share with your friends. Hopefully you learned a little something today. If not, maybe you got a little bit of a different perspective on it. I know I learned a few things from researching this one. Would you like to make any more comments?
I just have one more.
Okay.
Manassas Junction. Didn't we go to school with her?
Thank you.
Bullshit.